From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, Carl Zimmer will join us to talk about the power of heredity. Zimmer has written a massive book that is cleverly summed up by the title, She Has Her Mother's Laugh. The traits we share with our parents or kids, how does that work exactly? Zimmer says heredity can be a gift, it can be a curse, and it can define us. The history is pretty interesting, too. So's the science. Join us. Hi, it's Doug Fabrizio inviting you to go see our latest short film at Radio West Films. This is the animated story of Mormon pioneer Margaret Daglish, walked to Utah with a handcart, suffered incredible hardship, and came out of it a survivor. The historian Will Bagley tells the story. The Utah animator Ainsley Romero brings it to life. Go see it at radiowest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Heredity and genes are all the rage right now. Just spit in a tube, send in the package, and you can get a glimpse of your familial past. But Carl Zimmer says we may be expecting too much from our inherited genes. And in a new book, he says it's time to give heredity its due. From the size of the book, it's huge. You can tell this is a long story. And in our conversation, we were only able to touch on certain parts. There's the history part, how our thinking about heredity evolved as we came to understand the science. And then with the birth of genetics, this really took off, and we seem to be figuring it out. A lot of you have ordered genetic tests to help you make sense of the familial traits you share with your kinfolk. But in the book, Zimmer explains that each of us carries this amalgam of fragments of DNA, and they're stitched together from our many ancestors, and that each piece of these strands have their own pathway back through human history. Today in the program, Carl Zimmer is joining us to talk about the story of heredity. His book is called She Has Her Mother's Laugh, The Power, Perversions, and Potential of Heredity. Zimmer is a science writer. He's written the New York Times column Matter since 2004. He's the author of a number of books. He joined us from the studios at Yale University, where he teaches. Zimmer, of course, knows the science about all of this, but he really became interested in the history of heredity when his wife was pregnant with their first child, and their doctor suggested, you should go to a genetics counselor.
You know, I honestly didn't really see the point because I, you know, felt like, well, you know, I write about science. I write a lot about genetics, and so why do I need to go over this? This is going to be pointless. And I think the counselor kind of sensed that we weren't really interested in being there, yeah, and was very accommodating, but just started to ask us about our families. And, you know, it was really strange because I started trying to remember all of my relatives and trying to remember how the dead ones died exactly, and tried to remember people's medical history. And I suddenly realized, like, I don't really keep track of this stuff very well, do I? And now I'm going to be having a child, and I'm actually passing down the genes of my own ancestors to somebody new. Yeah. And I felt so incredibly irresponsible and almost panicked that that I kind of lost control during the meeting, and you know, the counselor again had to be very mellow and kind of talk me down a bit. But I think that really drove home to me for the first time how heredity, it's not, you know, an abstraction that you learn about in high school, you know, with Mendel's peas. It's something that is at the core of our being.
You say in the book, the more you talked about genes, the more alien they felt to you. What do you mean by that? Just that you saw the complication as it related to something personal going on now?
Well, I knew that I had genes, obviously. I knew I had 20,000 or so genes, like every other human. But I had no idea what kinds of genes I had. So this was 2000. This is way, way before the age of 23andMe. You know, the idea that someone would, you know, have sequenced your genome was a bit like going to the moon. And so I knew that I had passed down some of my genes to my daughter. I had no idea which ones, and I had no idea what they were going to do in terms of shaping her life. I suddenly felt like, well, shouldn't I know about that? But yeah. So, you know, I was starting to see this stream of genes in the over the flow of heredity that was passing through me, basically, and I had no idea what I was dealing with.
You say that as you started to dig into heredity, this is how you put it in the book. You said you found yourself in an underground palace. What do you mean?
Well, in the years since my first child was born, the science of genetics has exploded in a way that I really don't think anybody had anticipated. And so now scientists really are digging into this huge amount of information that each of us carries around in ourselves, our genome. And it's just fascinating to look at your own DNA and to see all the complexity in there and all the mystery that still waits to be figured out.
You say in the book that genes can't really give us what we really want from heredity. I wanted to ask you about that. What is it that and that also you say that we don't really give heredity its due. I guess that gets at our misperceptions of what it is we expect and what we know or what we want from the idea of heredity.
Yeah, so I think we want heredity, and in particular the genes we inherit, to explain everything about us.
Yeah.
And so we look really hard for similarities between ourselves and our ancestors, or those of us who have children. We look at our kids and try to see ourselves in them. And there are these phrases we'll use, like, I'm 6 foot, so I'm sort of on the tall side. My brother's 6'1". Our parents are not tall, and none of our relatives are tall either. So they all look up at us and they say, like, where did you get that from?
Yeah.
And you know, they start to think about, you know, some great uncle who was kind of tall. Like, oh, maybe you got it from him. As if that was the route by which we ended up the way we are. And that's just that's just not how heredity works at all. At the same time, I think we think too little of heredity.
Yeah.
You know, just to give one example, we tend to think about heredity as just going from one generation of people to the next generation of people, and that's it. So that once you're born, like in your own life, like heredity doesn't really enter into it. Yeah. But actually, there's a heredity inside you. Mm-hmm. You know, when you start out, you're one cell, and then that cell divides, and then those cells divide, and then those cells divide. That ancestral cell is actually called by scientists a mother cell. And then when it splits, those are called daughter cells. There is, in other words, a genealogy of cells inside of all of us. And scientists actually will draw genealogical trees of our cells and learn all sorts of things about how we become who we are in the process. Because that one cell, you know, it divides and divides and divides, and some of its descendants are going to become cells in your brain, and some are going to become your heart, and some are going to become your liver. And the way in which that process plays out, you can only understand it by understanding how cells inherit their characteristics from their mother cells.
Yeah. I wanted to back up and talk a little bit about the history of heredity that you write about early on in the book. And, of course, we have a much different concept of it now. You say in ancient times, of course, heredity wasn't at all biological. I mean, it was legal. It was about, I guess, prestige and possessions, I suppose.
Yeah, so the word heredity comes from the Latin hereditas, but that does not mean inheriting genes. It doesn't mean anything in terms of biology. What it means is inheriting rights or possessions that belonged to someone who's just died. And the Romans had all sorts of really elaborate rules for how hereditas would work. But that was basically a way to pass down these kinds of, you know, wealth and power from one generation to the next. And if you asked a Roman, well, okay, well, why is it that you look like your parents? They would kind of look at you funny and be like, well, why wouldn't I? I mean, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
You really cannot find anything in the ancient world, in Rome or Greece, where Westerners are talking about heredity the way we do, in terms of there being something invisible and microscopic that gets passed down through the generations. So when you look at the history of heredity, you're looking at just a different way of thinking about the things that we think about. So, you know, people would breed animals and plants, and that was all about heredity. But people really thought more in terms of the environment. You know, I mean, if you want to produce a good crop of olives, you know, it's not so much about breeding a good variety. It's about just making sure that you get enough rain and sunlight. In other words, it's the environment that produces the kinds of things that you want. And people thought about ourselves in the same way.
So they didn't understand how traits or resemblance were really passed on. They just figured that they were. When did this concept of heredity, you mentioned, for example, in the book, over the, you know, various centuries, Europeans came to believe that people were joined by blood, and then you get this idea of blood ancestry. Talk a little bit about how the idea does come to evolve.
It's fascinating that you start to see in the Middle Ages a use of the term of blood as a connection between the generations. And, you know, that you don't see that in a lot of other cultures. And it's kind of hard to figure out, well, how much of this is a metaphor and how much of this did people really think that, like, there was a sort of, you know, that there was blood that came from the parents that produced, that was coursing through their children. Yeah. It's really hard to figure that out. But people would talk about blood and different kinds of blood. In other words, they would start to distinguish people according to these things that they were inheriting biologically. In other words, you know, a nobleman had noble blood, and with that, and that meant that he could not help but be noble. Even if you raised him on a poor farm, he would just end up expressing that nobility. And this actually starts to really gain traction with genealogy, which noblemen use to justify inheriting all that wealth and power. You say, like, well, I'm king because I inherited that from all these generations back. And then at the same time, using blood to sort of talk about differences between groups of people. And the word you start to see in the 1400s for these differences is race.
Yeah.
This is really the first time that the word race gets used, and it starts to develop into this concept of people existing in very distinct groups, and every generation inherits things that set them apart from the other groups. So in the case of blacks, for example, there was a idea that the dark skin of Africans was a sign of the curse of Ham in the Bible, when Noah's son is cursed, and that they inherit that curse, and that their skin, which they also inherit, is a reflection of that. So really, the fact is that our modern ideas of heredity really start to emerge right alongside racism.
You begin with a story in the book of the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V, I think it was, and the story of heredity in the Habsburg dynasty. And I went and looked at some of the paintings and the portraits. The Habsburg job, it is so prominent. You write about it in the book, and it's really just an illustration of basically of inbreeding, how heredity was really misunderstood, and it seems like it kind of went awry. I mean, cousins marrying cousins, and talk a little bit about that, because I thought this was really interesting.
Yeah, I was fascinated by the fall of the Habsburg dynasty because it's happening in the 15, 1600s. You start off with this empire that is arguably the most powerful in the world, maybe alongside China. But, you know, you have these kings who are ruling over Spain, much of Europe, a lot of the New World. There's silver coming in on ships and so on. And, you know, they are passing down the royal power by basically keeping it in the royal family. And so these new monarchs are inheriting their power and their wealth, and then just trying to keep that inheritance within the family. And so they are looking to close relatives to marry to keep the empire intact. And at the very same time, they are getting sicker and sicker. They are suffering all sorts of different ailments, and they are struggling to have children. The children that they do have often die very young. In fact, they're having more trouble having children that can survive than Spanish peasants at the same time are. Yeah. These are the royals. And they also are taking on this incredibly distinctive look. They have this huge lower jaw. Actually, what it is that the upper jaw is sort of pulled back, but it gives this incredible distinctive appearance, which is called the Habsburg jaw. Yeah. And they actually are inheriting that. And all of this comes down to the fact that unbeknownst to them, they are basically running an experiment on heredity. They are marrying close relatives and then doing that again and again. And so if there is a very rare mutation on one copy of a gene carried by somebody, they may very well marry someone who has the same mutation on their genes. Mm-hmm. And then if their child inherits a defective copy of that gene from both parents, they're going to have a terrible hereditary disease. And so these royals
way back. I think it was something like 11,000 years ago. There's some
we believe.
Evidence
and
of that?
That jaw is actually a part. You know, there are some hints that it was happening even thousands of years before that on a very small scale. You can see some hints in, you know, the remains of plants, of their seeds and so on, that there may have been a little bit of domestication happening for many thousands of years before the agricultural revolution really takes off, say 9,000, 10,000 years ago, in places like the Middle East.
You tell the story of how we came, for example, to merino sheep and how merino wool became this precious commodity. And it seems like we always distinguished early on. Humans distinguished breeding animals and how the physiology of humans worked. It seems like we made a distinction between the two things. When did we put those two things together, do you think?
I think as you follow this into the 1700s and then into the 1800s, you start to see the emergence of ways of thinking about heredity the way we do. And this can include animal breeding, for example. I mean, there was a sheep breeder named Bakewell in Britain who actually created an entirely new breed of sheep. Yeah. Simply by being very careful about how he bred his own flock, looking at individuals and choosing which ones would breed, and then looking for other sheep from other farms that had characteristics he was interested in, and then suddenly producing a really desirable new breed. And so that sort of thing is starting to happen more and more on the sort of animal side and the plant side. At the same time, doctors are starting to think more and more about humans as having this fundamental similarity with animals, yeah. You know, in terms of our anatomy and in terms of the way the parts of our bodies function. And so heredity starts to be something that people start to think about in terms of people. And so actually some of the first examples of that are psychiatrists, yeah. Or as they might have been called then, alienists. You had psychiatrists who were caring for the insane in these asylums, and they were trying to understand the origins of madness. And one of the things that they would start to do is keep records of their patients and the families of their patients. And they started to notice that it seemed like it was awfully common for their patients to be related to other people who also had various forms of madness.
Yeah.
And so that developed this idea that there might be things that were being passed down from generation to generation in people that was affecting their behavior.
Darwin was interested in how humans went mad. I mean, he was in The Origin of Species, for example. He explores natural selection, but he can't really explain the biology of what made it possible. What did Darwin come to know, or how did he think about heredity? What did he understand about it?
Well, Darwin is developing his theory of evolution right at this time when heredity is really starting to emerge in the basic concept of the way we think of it. And what's important to Darwin is that his whole theory of evolution, of species begetting new species and so on, none of it's going to work without heredity. In other words, you have to have individuals that can pass down their traits to the next generation, and then you have natural selection making some of those traits more common over time. And so heredity is right at the core of his theory, but you know, he's looking around trying to say, like, well, what is heredity? So he's reading these psychiatry textbooks. He's fascinated by them. He's reading about Bakewell and his sheep. He's looking everywhere he can for any clue about heredity. And he's really struggling because there are these odd patterns, you know, that you know, when you cross different breeds together, you can get these hybrids, which are all kind of different from each other. And why is that? And he's really struggling. And so he is looking at some of the developments that are going on with our understanding of cells and what's inside of cells. And, you know, researchers are looking through microscopes and discovering this whole hidden world of different molecules packed inside of our cells. And he says, okay, here's my idea. I think that our cells contain some kind of particles that determine what they are. And some of those particles stream down through the body to the sex cells, to sperm and to eggs. And the sperm and the eggs carry those particles, and in fertilization, they're combined. And then somehow, when that cell starts to divide, the traits of the parents are then passed on somehow to the offspring. You know, to us, it seems kind of weird and wild, but that was the best that he could think of at the time. And, you know, it pretty quickly turned out that it didn't hold up to scrutiny. So, you know, he went to his grave really having no idea about how heredity works.
I want to ask about misconceptions throughout the years about how traits are passed along. You write about Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, and he has his own theory about this. And then there's this zoologist, August Weissmann, who challenges this idea. But it's an interesting story, I think. I wanted you to talk a little bit about it because it raises these questions of whether you can pass down, like, a particular trait. And this is plays into a bigger question of whether you can pass along intellectual capabilities or fears or valor or any of these kinds of ideas. But it seems like this was early on when they were thinking about this.
Well, you can actually go back to the ancient Greeks and can see that they had a lot of ideas that were kind of similar to what Lamarck was saying. In other words, that if parents had an experience, it could affect their children and their children's children and so on. And so this came to be known eventually as the inheritance of acquired characteristics. Yeah. So what Lamarck does is he takes this idea that, well, basically everybody is agreeing to and turns it into the basis for his own theory of evolution. This is actually coming about 50 years before Darwin presents his own theory. So one of the ways that life evolves, Lamarck said, was because organisms were having these experiences in life that could then affect their offspring. And to Lamarck, why this mattered was because it could explain why species were adapted to their environment.
Yeah.
So they inherited these characteristics, and through the process, they adapted. And the classic example is the giraffe. So you have a giraffe that is eating leaves off of trees, and you know, if it stretches its neck, it can reach the higher leaves and eat more food. And in that stretching, Lamarck believed that that actually could actually extend the length of a giraffe's neck. And then that would then be passed down to its offspring. And so over many generations, you'd have this neck getting longer and longer and longer and longer, making the giraffe better adapted to its environment. You know, Darwin, for the most part, had a different view of evolution. He really believed that, you know, all that happened was that some individuals were just born with certain traits, and they, you know, some of those traits meant that they survived longer and reproduced more, and other traits meant that individuals died sooner. And so over many generations, it was just, you just have these traits getting spread through natural selection. So the experience wouldn't have any real impact. You know, Darwin actually warmed up to Lamarck over the years. That's an interesting twist to all of this. But actually, by the end of the 1800s, people really were really rejecting Lamarck pretty much outright. And so August Weismann, this German biologist, did these experiments where, for example, he would cut the tails off of mice and see if that had any effect on the future generations. And they didn't. And so he said, you know, like, this is evidence that Lamarck was wrong. And as people started to understand how genes actually work over the next few decades, in the early 1900s, it made Lamarck even harder to justify.
You write a bit about Francis Galton, who was Darwin's cousin, of course, and the idea that understanding evolution would depend on making sense of heredity, he thinks, and he saw heredity as passing along these virtues, and that sort of leads from one thing to another and gets us to this idea of eugenics, and you spend some time with that in the book. And there's one particular story about that I wanted to ask you about. This is the Vineland Training School. This is a story in New Jersey. And this really sad story of this woman named Emma Wolverton. Tell us a little bit about this idea of these people like Galton and others in this particular story trying to save race, purify the race through heredity.
So Francis Galton is very influenced by his cousin Charles Darwin, and you know, reads The Origin of Species, and it kind of gets him thinking in his own way about the nature of heredity. And he's particularly interested in human heredity. He wants to understand what makes people different from each other or similar to each other. So he's very fascinated by twins, and he collects all these stories about twins who end up doing almost identical things even though they've been separated. He goes through history books and collates examples of families where there are famous or prominent people that are related to each other. And he's claiming that genius is inherited. He actually publishes a book called Hereditary Genius. All this stuff sounds a little flaky in hindsight, but the fact is that he also did a lot of the fundamental research and thinking that lay the groundwork for the way we study heredity today. Yeah. So, for example, he would study height, and he would ask, well, why is it that tall parents tend to have tall children and short parents tend to have short children? And he developed these methods for measuring the influence of your parents, of heredity, on how tall you end up being. So with all this work, Galton is a very wealthy man in Victorian England and feels completely entitled to figure out how to make all of society a better place. And his feeling is that, well, you just need to treat people like animals and breed them. In other words, if genius is inherited, then you just encourage all the really talented people to get together and have a lot of kids. And he coined the name for it in the 1880s called eugenics. So eugenics actually has a rather sort of positive kind of beginning. Galton talks about, oh, what a galaxy of genius we might create with eugenics. But in the United States, people adopt eugenics, but it starts to take a much darker turn. And I focus on one example of that, a story that played out in New Jersey in the early 1900s. There was a school there for the quote-unquote feeble-minded, and there was a girl who was brought there named Emma Wolverton. And she's basically an inconvenience. Her parents want to get rid of her, basically. And so she just gets accustomed to living in this institution. She learns how to do all sorts of things, does woodworking and waitressing and teaching kindergarten, whatever. she has a pretty normal life, except that she's a prisoner, basically.
Yeah.
And then a psychologist arrives while she's a teenager there named Henry Goddard, and he brings intelligence testing to the Vineland School. He's running the first sort of precursors to IQ tests in the United States. And so he tests Emma Wolverton and all the other students there. And he decides that Emma Wolverton has a mental age that's slightly behind her chronological age. So she's not, you know, what they would call an idiot or an imbecile. She's something else, and he needs a name for it. And he calls her – he reaches back to the Greek – a word for a fool, and calls her a moron. So he coins the term moron. And then he's discovering genetics and eugenics and all the rest of it. And so he goes out and sends out field workers to interview the relatives of people like Emma Wolverton at the school, and convinces himself that feeble-mindedness is a genetic trait that's passed down through families, through the generations. Emma Wolverton becomes sort of a classic example of it. He actually writes a whole book about her family, and it becomes a big bestseller, very influential.
Yeah.
And then Goddard and others take the next step. They say, well, we can't let these people spread their genes to future generations. We have to stop them. So one way to stop them is to keep them in institutions like Emma Wolverton was. She stayed in institutions until her death in the late 1970s. And also, if you can't put everybody in institutions because there's so many of these feeble-minded people, sterilize them.
Yep.
So laws are then passed by a number of states in the United States to sterilize people deemed unfit. There are scientists in Nazi Germany who look at what Henry Goddard has to say about Emma Wolverton and others, and they grab all this stuff. They use it as proof positive that they have to go forward with the Nazi program, which involves not just sterilization but eventually extermination.
Carl Zimmer, his book is called She Has Her Mother's Laugh. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. A lot of people want to know, does Doug really read all those books? The answer, yeah, he does. No one really knows how, but we do know that he gets up very early. If you want to try keeping up with him, you can buy the book by clicking on the indie bookstores, Amazon, or Audible links at the bottom of the episode page. If you do, some of the proceeds go to support Radio West. So thanks for that, and thanks for listening. Here's the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the science writer Carl Zimmer. We're talking about his latest book, She Has Her Mother's Laugh, The Power, Perversions, and Potential of Heredity. What do you make of this kind of modern obsession with genetic ancestry? You've said that in the book, sometimes we look at our DNA as some sort of divine revelation about who we are. Do you think we have a proper understanding of quite how it works?
One reason that I wanted to write the book is to help people to come to terms with the fact that we can now actually all look at our own DNA. I mean, this is amazing. Like, millions and millions of people are getting their DNA tested, and they're looking at all these different traits that are encoded in their DNA, and they're trying to make sense of them. On the one hand, I think it's astonishing and amazing that we have this technology to do this. On the other hand, you know, all these results are only going to make sense if we really get a deep appreciation for how heredity works.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think for a lot of us, you know, maybe the last time we really thought seriously about this was, you know, when we were in high school studying for a test on Mendel and his pea plants. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot has happened since then. And our understanding of how genes work together to produce traits and how they are acting in the environment and how the environment influences the genes. There's so much fascinating stuff that scientists are finding out about, and it really overturns a lot of our more sort of simple ideas about what it means to inherit a gene from somebody. Mm. You know, like there are very few genes, for example, that are entirely responsible for some trait.
Yeah.
You know, your blood type, that's a good example. Like there's a gene for your blood type, that's fine. But how tall you are, well, that's very strongly influenced by genes. But you know, scientists so far have found about 3,000 different genetic variants spread out through the human genome that play some role in how tall you are.
Yeah.
Now, each one of those variants might adjust your height a tiny fraction of an inch. But if you add them all up, you get, you know, the incredible range of heights that you can see in humans. So, you know, I think it's, you know, I'm certainly obsessed by being able finally now to look at my own DNA. And, you know, my daughter got her DNA tested and, you know, now we're looking at that too. And it's fascinating, but you have to dig deeper than our sort of commonly shared ideas about heredity to appreciate what we're seeing.
Carl, how do you talk about the risks, I guess, maybe that's not the right word, but to finding out what's in your genome? I mean, you had yours sequenced, and you talk about how you were kind of nervous about finding out. I mean, your father's parents, for example, died pretty young. And you've even talked about how if something turned up in that genome that was troubling, concerning, that you weren't sure you were going to write about it. So how do you talk about whether people should or shouldn't do this and what they should and shouldn't find out and how they should prepare themselves for something like that?
My advice would be to be prepared for the small chance of getting some very disturbing news the much larger chance of getting a really boring result.
That's what happened to you. Yours was kind of boring.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I actually went and got my whole genome sequence and a genetics counselor, you know, went through it with a clinical geneticist. And they were looking for these thousands of different disorders that are known to be caused by single mutations. And you know, there was all this buildup to it. And I was like, oh, my gosh, I'm getting my genome sequenced. I just cannot imagine that we're at the point now where this is possible. And here we go. And then the genetics counselor calls and says, hey, hi, I just wanted to call because we got your results. And I'm just, you know, gripping the desk. And I'm like, and? And she's like, oh, well, you don't need to, like, come into the office or anything. We can just do this over the phone. And then she says, well, there's nothing. Like, there's nothing here that makes us concerned.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
And it is sort of like when you go to the doctor's office, and in this weird way, you really want the doctor to tell you something really, like, concrete about some terrible thing that you have. And if they say, like, you know, I think you got some virus, and just wait a couple of days, you'll feel better. You sort of feel disappointed, which is so bizarre.
Yeah.
And so I had that feeling. Now, there will be a fraction of people, a small fraction of people, who will discover through gene sequencing that they have a serious risk factor for something. Now, it depends on what kind of test you get. I mean, a lot of these places will not actually give you a lot of these kind of medical results because there are big questions about directed consumer services.
Sure.
But even if you go to a place, let's say like Ancestry.com, where they're more interested in genealogy, you can get a different kind of shock to the system. I mean, there are a small but growing number of people who discover, well, you know, their father isn't actually their father, or their, you know, sister isn't really their sister, or, you know, they were always told that they're from Ireland, and lo and behold, they're Jewish. And, like, you can discover that your family has been lying to you. Or that they told themselves a story and didn't realize it wasn't true. You know, I I was talking with someone recently who was very unsettled because he's white. He's from Oklahoma. And lots of people from places like Oklahoma are white will say like, oh, I'm part Cherokee. You know, my parents always told me I was part Cherokee.
Yeah.
And first of all, to be Cherokee means something fundamentally cultural, like that you actually have to be enrolled in the tribe. You have to have a real cultural connection to being Cherokee. It's not just something you get on a gene test. But this person actually found that he didn't have any Native American ancestry in him at all. And he was really flummoxed because he's like, well, I gave my son a middle name from Cherokee. And like, this is part of who I am. What do I do now? And I just said, well, you're just going to like have to come to terms with the fact that, you know, maybe you've been told a myth since you were a child. And that's going to be hard. But that's one of the things that genetic testing can possibly help you with. On the other hand, I will say that you do need to be cautious about interpreting these results. So with ancestry tests, for example, a lot of it is still quite rough.
Yeah.
Because all they're doing is they're comparing segments of your DNA to segments that have been analyzed in millions of other people from all sorts of different parts of the world. The results are only as good as the database they can compare them to. And if you have ancestry from certain parts of the world, especially parts outside of Western Europe, you're going to get really rough and sometimes misleading results.
Where are we headed, though, along those lines? Because you mentioned we're coming to a point, I'm not sure if it's the distant future, but not, maybe not so distant future, where we could be able to really pinpoint our ancestors to a town. I mean, we could get pretty specific, it seems.
Well, the fact is that on certain scales of time, people don't move around much.
Yeah.
So you might have people living generation after generation around a village in, say, Ireland for 400 years and just not budging. And so what that means is that, you know, if you have a small group of people living in one place and mostly, you know, having kids with each other, they're going to develop a set of genetic markers that is going to be pretty distinctive, you know, distinctive enough that you can go and look at people elsewhere and potentially say, oh, well, you know, you have at least some ancestors who came from around this village. That's the goal of some of the more ambitious gene sequencing projects that are out there in terms of understanding ancestry. At the same time, though, like you have to just, you know, you have to be, again, cautious about what it means to say that, you know, you come from some village in Ireland.
I mean, right.
It's not some eternal, unchanging thing to be Irish. I mean, you know, 15,000 years ago, there were no people in Ireland. that doesn't mean that they popped into existence one day. It means that they came from somewhere else.
Right.
And not only that, and actually there were several waves of people who came to Ireland over thousands of years, and they were very genetically different from each other. You know, some of them had their roots in what is now Turkey. Some of them had their roots in what is now Russia. And they came together in northwestern Europe, and they interbred and mixed their genes together. And so, you know, what we might call Irish is just this melange of different groups of ancestors.
Mm. One of the things you write about in the book is you write about this experience in the lab of Anthony James, who's engineering mosquito genes, I guess, so that they're resistant to malaria. And it raises that bigger question of, you know, what happens when you change the rules of heredity. A lot of the stuff we can't take back. And it's one of the things you write about is that we should learn from our experiences in the past and the tools we've already invented that have altered our inheritance over the last, you know, 10, 11,000 years or whatever it is. What do you think we have the capacity to learn those lessons? And I mean, and the risks versus the benefits, how are you thinking about this future?
So we have had the capacity to, you know, engineer genes for, you know, maybe 40 years or so. Scientists learned, for example, how to take a human gene, say for insulin, and stick it into E. coli bacteria. And then all of a sudden, the E. coli starts producing insulin, which is a great thing because you can fill up a fermentation tank with bacteria and have it churn out insulin for people with diabetes. Now, the thing, though, is that, you know, if you were to just engineer a mosquito to be resistant to malaria, which, you know, people can do, and you set that mosquito loose or even set 100 mosquito loose, they go into a population of thousands or millions of other mosquitoes that don't carry that gene.
Yeah.
And over several generations, there'll be lots of breeding, and then, you know, that gene may just disappear because you know, they it gets passed down. It doesn't provide any particular benefit to the mosquito, and poof, it's gone. So you went to all that effort for nothing. So actually what's happening now is that scientists have basically figured out a way of overriding Mendel's law and to say, like, okay, if a mosquito inherits one copy of this malaria resistance gene, it will actually have the capacity to rewrite the other copy of the gene. So now it has two copies of the resistance gene. And so now all of its offspring will inherit the resistance gene. And that tweak means that theoretically, if you were to release, say, a few hundred or thousand of these engineered mosquitoes into a place where there's lots of malaria, within just a few years, all of the mosquitoes in the region would inherit resistance to malaria. And the thinking is that, well, maybe malaria would be eradicated from that region,
you know, as a result.
The fact is that we have hundreds of thousands of people dying every year of malaria. And while there's lots of work on vaccines and anti-malarial drugs, they're still not stopping a pretty huge death toll.
Yeah.
So it's really important to look for new solutions. But on the other hand, we want to make sure these solutions don't cause really bad risks. And we know that in the past we've made some mistakes with introducing species into new places. The best example I know of is the cane toad. So in Australia, people thought that they could control the pests in the sugarcane farms by importing a frog, a toad from South America. And lo and behold, it gets to Australia. And yeah, these insects that are feeding on the sugarcane, they're fine, but you know what I really want to eat, says the toad, is that cute little marsupial mammal over there.
Yeah.
And the cane toads produce a poison that means that the predators can't eat them, or if they try to eat them, they die. And it's just been a catastrophe for Australian wildlife ever since. And the worst thing is that no one knows how to take them back. They're all over parts of Australia, and no one has a clue how to take them back. So if we release mosquitoes into the wild, we have to reckon with the possibility that we might not be able to take them back even if something bad happens. So some scientists are trying to engineer ways to basically have a kind of a kill switch, as it were.
Yeah.
So this is all very new, and you know, the research is all very much limited to highly protected labs like one that I visited for the book. But, you know, maybe in 10 years some of these mosquitoes are going to be flying loose.
Well, so finally, I guess, when you think about gene, you know, CRISPR technology and all of the kind of exciting technologies for the future, do you think we have the, you know, the wisdom and the restraint to head in this direction? I mean, where did you come to any sort of conclusion about all of that when you look at the history that you wrote about and then now looking at the future?
Well, the history of heredity is littered with all sorts of terrible examples that we have to avoid at all costs. You know, eugenics provides many of these. I mean, it's not like eugenics was being promoted by some fringe characters. Eugenics in the United States was embraced by the leading lights of science and other fields. And part of the problem was that they thought that their very crude understanding of genetics was all they needed to understand to explain human nature. And it just so happened that their explanation of human nature aligned perfectly with, you know, old biases and prejudices from decades earlier. So we have to ask ourselves, you know, as we get power with these tools to alter heredity, what choices are we making? What values are we basing our choices on? And are we justified in those? And what risks are we willing to take, or what risks are we willing to have other people take for our own benefit? We have to ask all these questions. I don't think that we should just be paralyzed in the face of these things and say, no, can't touch any of it. People could have said that about any great advance in medicine, you know, from vaccines to antibiotics. But we have advanced, and we should continue to do so. But we need to keep asking these questions, especially when it comes to heredity, because, you know, if you're going to say, like, I think that we should change the genes in human embryos to eradicate disease. Well, just bear in mind, you're making a decision for someone who isn't born yet, and also potentially for future generations as well. So is that a decision you have the right to make? And what are the risks that you may have been kind of presumptuous in what you thought was best for them? I mean, some people say, like, well, obviously, Huntington's disease, we have to get rid of that. Some people may argue that deafness is a disease that has to be eradicated. Some people might say, you are a dwarf. Well, that's a condition we never want to see again, and pathologize that as well.
Right.
Where do you draw that line?
Carl Zimmer, his latest book is She Has Her Mother's Laugh, The Power, Perversions, and Potential of Heredity. Radio West is a production of KUVR News. Our thanks to Tess Goodwin. We have technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.